This morning, we are going to begin our discussion with some topics on genetics. As you know, genetics is going to be the wave of the future, both in terms of the diagnostics, in terms of the treatment. It's going to reshape how we understand medicine. It's going to, the practice of medicine in the next two decades is certainly going to be very different than the traditional medical school curriculum that we are accustomed to. An area within genetics, which is even more in terms of new frontiers, is this idea of epigenetics. And for those that are uninitiated yet, or have just been touched a little bit about it, it's really the influence of the environment to the actual genes and how it expresses itself. And it's a privilege and an honor to have Dr. John Loicki with us, who is an expert in this area. Dr. John Loicki could not be here for Shabbos because of his other multiple commitments elsewhere, but we are really pleased that he's able to join us this morning. He is it's in your bio, but I think I just want to just point out a little bit now. He's a professor of biology and the director of the special programs in the Center for Bioethics at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons, and he focuses on white blood cells as well, Parkinson's, cancer, but he has authored and co-authored multiple books. He has worked with Rabbi Tendler. He'll tell you more about some of his fascinating work that he's done in China and Bangkok, Thailand, in terms of medical teaching. But an area of his of specialty is this idea of epigenetics. So without further ado, it's my great privilege to call upon Dr. John Loicki to talk to us this morning about epigenetics. Okay, I'll bring your clicker and I'll put the...
Thank you very much. Do I need the microphone?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. It's really an honor to be here. As I was driving up last night after Shabbos, I was thinking, and the title of this whole conference, Torah in Motion, is very appropriate. Because really, when you look at the way Torah Halacha it has developed, it's really very responsive to all the new biotechnologies that's happening. And it's really an incredible bracha that we have the capacity to deal with these very complex issues. The other thing, as I was eating breakfast, as I saw some of my old colleagues that I haven't seen in a long time, I was thinking back 20 years ago when I was at Rockefeller, and I was only doing science. I didn't know a thing about medical ethics or bioethics. And then they cloned Dolly, and I spoke to my dear friend Avram Steinberg. I said, let's write an article about the ethics of cloning. And I never thought I'd be here. It's an honor to be here, and I thank all the organizers. I'd never thought in 20 years I'd be speaking all over the world about medical ethics, and it's not my fault. In part, it's Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg's fault. We wrote the first paper together on this, and we've been, friends and colleagues for many years. And also I have to thank, of course, my wife, who's pushed me into this. And the last person that I owe this to is Rabbi Tendler, who I've been writing with for the last 15 years. And B'li Ayin Hara, it's an amazing honor to be with him. So thank you, and let me tell you a little bit. This is a very intelligent, highly educated audience. I'm trying to put epigenetics within a spectrum that covers those who don't know anything what it is, those who know a lot about it. I'm open to any questions, so feel free to ask me anything. One of the things that I think is very important is that genetics is not properly understood by both physicians, scientists, and especially rabbinical leaders. So let me start, if I can figure out how to do this. Which one is it? Nope. Running auto. Which one is the, this one probably. Okay, let's go. And which is it? It's the up arrow, no? This up arrow? This one, okay. So let me tell you what genetics is. And again, in very simple terms, you all know this. This is the holy grail, the genetic code. Incorporates letters, about 6.4 million letters, and it really encodes a set of instructions that tells you, these are called the genotype, They're encoded, and the instructions provide a phenotype. How these genetic instructions manifest into physical characteristics, biological, it's all pretty obvious. And of course, as you all know, genes come in very different flavors. They're responsible for diseases, height, intelligence, eye color, et cetera. That's what everybody understands. But there's a certain traditional dogma which I would like to bring up to date, which I think is not true. The first thing is that a lot of people believe that your genetic code determines your destiny and what you're going to be. That's absolutely not true. Genetics is a probability. You have a genetic set of instructions, but that's regulated. And that's all relates to epigenetics. And it's not just because you have a certain gene pattern that doesn't mean you're going to come down with the characteristics that the genes say. The second thing is that we know that 5%, maybe 2% or 5% of DNA is used to provide the specific genetic instructions. And that is translated into proteins. And the rest is always, look at any of the textbooks, it's called junk DNA. And of course, we know that God does not create junk. And we're now learning that these non-encoding genes are very, very important in regulating your whole genomic instructions. And we don't have a lot of details. It's just coming out very slowly. The third point is that all humans are about 99% identical in the DNA letters, the nucleotides. And of course, that's a misnomer because that means that we differ from each other in about 34 million letters. We're very, very different, rather than looking at just genes. The fourth is probably the most difficult one, is that most people believe the mitochondria and mitochondrial DNA is maternally inherited. Let me tell you, in every cell of your body, almost every dividing cell, you have two sources of DNA. Most of it is thought to be in the nuclear, that's where your chromosomes, and the other is the mitochondria. And up until a few months ago, everybody was taught that mitochondrial DNA is maternally transmitted, and in fact, there's now evidence for paternal mitochondrial transmission. We know this. I know doing mouse studies that mitochondrial DNA, mouse, chickens, we can go on, it's both paternal and maternal. There now, we've identified about 17 individuals where there's clear paternal transmission. How common that is, I don't know, but that has a lot of halakhic ramifications in terms of how you paskin, in terms of the role of mitochondrial, in terms of parenthood, in terms of identifying somebody who's Jewish. And that has to be the other thing that people don't appreciate is mitochondria is more than just information to control your cell battery. Mitochondrial DNA influences physical traits, behavioral traits. It's a very integral part. Without mitochondria, none of us would be here. Okay, the fifth one is the father of genetics is Gregory Mendel. Again, it's a misnomer. The real father is Yaakov Avinu. If you all look in the Parsha of the Tzon, he understood not only dominance, recessive, and he even understood epigenetics, although he didn't know how to define it that way, but neither did Mendel. And finally, that moral behavior is learned. And again, that's not true. It's both, there's a genetic and learned component of moral behavior. We can knock out regions of the brain, and you can completely change the whole moral attitude and behavior of a person. There are a lot of clinical studies showing that. So that's my introduction. Now, to understand epigenetics, we have to understand why it's important. We all know what mutations are. Mutations can be beneficial. They can be have very harmful effects. And, of course, they have no effects. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you should know this. I heard it from a good source. When he created Adam, Harishon, he did not give him a perfect genome. And that's very important to understand. And we all carry mutations. And how we deal with them and what we do with them is going to be very important. Now, what is epigenetics? So everybody knows the famous story of the ger who comes to Shammai. He says, teach me all of Torah, al ragalachas. And he says, I can't. He goes to Hillel. And Hillel, of course, says, I'll give you one principle. That which is harmful to you, do not do your fellow. This is the whole Torah. The rest is explanation. Go and learn. And what really people don't know is that another person, a scientist, came to Shammai and Hillel asked the same question, what is epigenetics? And this is what Hillel said. engage in gene therapy that benefits humankind and does not harm people. This is the basic lesson of gene regulation. The last is all explanation, go and learn. And that's really what it's about. Epigenetics teaches us a little bit of insight on how genes are turned on and turned off. And that's the basic lesson. You can view it as if the genes, the code, the actual letters, are the hardware of our genetic code, then epigenetics is a software program that regulates what is going on and what's going off. And as a very stupid analogy, it's like the Tikkun, right? The letters of the Torah are all written. There's no sentence structure, nothing. And on the right side, you have the Torah. And of course, in the Tikkun, you have all the, or left or right, whatever it is. On the right side here, you have all the trup. And the trup and the sentence structures inform you what those instructions are. And that's what epigenetics is. It informs you what the instructions, how to translate these instructions into reality. Now, why is epigenetics important? So I'll give you some examples. We all were created from a fertilized egg. The genetics of the fertilized egg is clear. We have 22,000 genes. And yet, this fertilized egg develops into muscle cells, neurons, macrophages, microglial cells, et cetera, et cetera. How is it possible if we all have the same genetic information? So what happens is that this fertilized egg, as it develops into an embryo, into a fetus, has to turn on and to turn off different genes because a muscle cell has a different genetic signature of what genes are turned on, what genes are turned off. A neuron has different signature, what genes are turned on and turned off. And that is all regulated by gene regulation, and a lot of it is coming from epigenetics. I should point out epigenetics is only one process of gene regulation. The other parameters here that I don't have time to go into. That's the first thing. So it allows the embryo to develop into all of the 200 different types of cells and tissue in the human body. Now, you can view epigenetics as a chemical switch. We've identified millions of these switches. There are 22,000 genes, and we've identified close to 2 million of these switches. And they include hundreds of switches that control diseases being turned on or turned off. And this is more than the total number of genes. And that's why these switches are so important in understanding the whole gestalt of your genes. So when you think about it, it, as I told you, underscores how you generate stem cells from an adult cell. Not only can you go from a fertilized egg to an adult cell, now we have the technology, take an adult cell, I can take any one of your skin cells, your epithelial cells, and convert them to gamete-like cells and use that to generate a viable embryo. And how do I do that? Because it's an epithelial cell, it's not a sperm. But we can do that by regulating these epigenetic mechanisms and turning them on and off, and we can convert an adult cell to an embryonic stem cell. It's all by an epigenetic mechanism. The other important principle is that epigenetics is inheritable. Again, it's a probability. It doesn't mean that every epigenetic marker is going to be passed on, but there's a lot of evidence that we have specific lifestyles, as pointed out, that it's the interface of nature and nurture. There's certain lifestyles that can be inherited not only to your children, but to your grandchildren as well. And for example, a very old study on epigenetics was shown that descendants of Holocaust survivors have lower levels of hormone called cortisol, and this helps them to recover from the traumatic events that they face in the future. It's all in the epigenetics. The unfortunate experience that they went through the Holocaust had lifelong effects in the future. And again, it's only a probability. There are some aspects of epigenetics that are reversible, some are not, some are inherited, some are not. We don't have a lot of information. I don't have a lot of information. It's going to take decades to work all of this out. But what I can tell you, which is very important, is we have clear markers. I can take any of your cells and look and identify all the epigenetic markers on your genes, what gene is affected by what switch, turning on and off. Those biochemical markers are very important in trying to understand some of the principles that I've done. So this is all an introduction. I'm giving you the signs before I go into the actual halacha part of this. So clear examples is you have identical twins, same genome, and yet one will be born with one hair color, when we be born with another hair color. And I think this cartoon says a lot about epigenetics. You don't look anything like the long, hairy, skinny kid I married 25 years ago. I need a DNA sample to make sure it's still you. I think that's a very important insight into epigenetics. Now, one of the most interesting things about, and again, one of the earlier studies, is that bees, a queen bee, will lay genetically identical larvae. If you feed one of those larvae with regular honey, it turns into a worker bee, shown on the left. It only has a half-life of about a few months after the end of the season, dies. But if you feed that larva the same genetics with royal honey, the honey that's produced by a queen, it turns into a queen bee. It lives for many, many years, and it looks very different. It's the same genetics. What is happening here is that you have epigenetic markers that change not only the genome, but the whole lifestyle and the whole phenotype of the thing. Now, as many of you know, royal jam used to be very expensive because there's the idea it could promote longevity. I don't know if that's true or not, at least in humans and bees, it definitely does. But what's really interesting is that when you add this royal, there's ingredients within this royal honey that promotes stem cell rejuvenation, and that is associated with longevity. So in the bee, we're beginning to understand how this food can dramatically increase lifespan from a few months to several years. And hopefully, maybe not, we'll figure out how we can apply that to human beings. Okay. What are the medical implications of epigenetics? Why don't all gene mutations lead to disease? You're going to read about this, or you're going to hear about this in the next session. We know if a woman has BRCA, any one of the many mutations, there are hundreds of mutations, not thousands, the chances are they're Orthodox, if they're Ashkenazic Jews, they have a probability within their lifetime, 80% come down with breast cancer. Why isn't it 100%? It's genetic. They have a mutation. Okay? And Gaucher's disease. Anybody who works with Gaucher's disease knows that you can have the right mutation, and one patient will be symptom-free the whole life, and the other patient will have to undergo medication and analysis for all the various things. Same mutation, same gene. All right? You have Tay-Sachs. Tay-Sachs was always thought to be fatal, you know, and now we're understanding there are women who have a certain mutations in the gene that they have late onset Tay-Sachs. They have this mutation, and they develop Tay-Sachs not at birth, but at 20 or 30 years old. And there's now recent evidence that dysregulation of epigenetics, if you don't know how to put the markers on the right place, it can lead to various aspects of autism and various Asperger's spectrum. And finally, we know that there are natural compounds from foods that are potential epigenetic anti-cancer agents. So all of this, all of these facts all relate to how epigenetics works. So in a sense, it reformates the principle of nature versus nurture, how you eat, how you sleep, the stress, the exercise, all of this is very important in putting real switches onto your DNA to regulate how you're going to turn up and how you're going to age, etc. So this is an example of what you shouldn't do. But what is the mechanism? So let me take a few minutes to try to explain to you. We all know what DNA is. It's coiled. If you take DNA from a single cell and stretch it out, it's about 7 or 8 feet long. How does that fit into a microscopic cell? It's coiled around specific proteins called histones. They're very, very important proteins. That's shown here. And there's two mechanisms by which epigenetics works. The first is that it can add, there are specific enzymes that can add a methyl group to the actual letters, to the thyme, to the ATCG. It adds it to the letters. And if it adds this methyl group to the DNA code, it prevents the DNA polymerase from replicating, it prevents the RNA polymerase from replication, from translation. It has very inhibitory effects. It basically turns off the gene if you have a methyl group. The other way it works is it can methylate not the DNA, but these histones. Histones are very important. So if it methylates a histone, again, it will turn off that region that is encircled by the histone protein. If it acetylates the histone, it like opens up the DNA and becomes more accessible to the RNA polymerases, and it turns on genes. So methylation usually turns off genes, but acetylation of the histones will turn on a gene. These are the three mechanisms, and we can measure them precisely in a lab. It's not cheap, but we can do that. Okay, what is the impact of lifestyles on epigenetics? So there are a lot of examples that we know that epigenetically activating certain genes in the brain that are associated with pleasure and reward will lead to monogamous behavior. Amazing. All right? This is all guilt by association. We haven't done all the molecular mechanisms yet. Being obese increases the likelihood that your children and your grandchildren will become obese. This is hereditary. Not 100%, but we have in mice we've done it, in humans, there's clear evidence. Certain diets are resilient to stress and reduce depression in women and their children. Now, this tends to something which I think is really true. What is the ideal lifestyle diet of epigenetics? It's a Shiva Minim. If you go through each of the Shiva Minim that the Torah says, it's clear that it promotes longevity, promotes health by epigenetic mechanisms. I don't think any parish in Torah says this, so it may be false, but that's my own impression. So if you want a good diet, Shiva Minim. All right. Other lifestyles. Stress during pregnancy leads to developmental disorders in some of the offspring. Maternal anxiety and depression leads to obstetric complications, increased risk of schizophrenia and depression in the child. This is an amazing one. If you fast, now, of course, the study was done clinically, secularly. Nobody said six times a year, but I'm sure it's true. If you fast, it will promote longevity. They have a lot of study. Again, guilt by association, we haven't done the mechanism yet. And of course, an obese grandfather can make their grandchildren more likely to develop diabetes. So again, an example of being hereditary. Okay, lack of sleep has been linked to weight gain, reduction of lean muscle mass, increased risk of diabetes, working by epigenetics. Regular exercise of men who want to engage in fertility will affect the sperm and impact the mental fitness of their offspring. Okay, cuddling babies can help them grow up to become adults. That's proof here. And what are the, now I go to the next part. What are the halakhic implications of epigenetics? And again, this is, this part, I have to thank Rabbi Tendler, who's really played a large role in this. We have an article coming out in Chakira in the next 6 months on this. And this is really complicated stuff, the halakhic. So not only have, of course, Rabbi Tendler's good enough, but I've run a lot of this by other Gedolim, Rabbi David Goldwasser, Rabbi Flaum, et cetera, and to make sure that what we're saying is not too much out of the box. But A, it says something very important. The woman who is carrying a child has a halakhic obligation to live a healthy lifestyle. Because chavala, on yourself, there may be certain rules to be matir. But if you cause injury to somebody else, you can't do it. So if you're pregnant and you don't have a healthy lifestyle, you're not only going to affect the health of the child that you're carrying, but you're going to affect potentially the health of future generations. I can't tell you how many generations. We don't know that as yet. At least three, at least two or three. So that there's a halakhic obligation if you're pregnant or if you're engaged, if you want to be become the mitzvah peruvia, to really, really live a healthy lifestyle, diet, less stress, do everything that you can to ensure healthy children. And the second thing is that it impacts the halakhic status of motherhood and surrogacy. As you know, I'm sure you've heard about this, read, there's a tremendous controversy within the halakhic literature. Do we identify motherhood by a genetic basis or by gestational? Another is the mother who gives birth, the halachic mother, or is it the genetic halachic mother? And there's a lot of debate on this, from saying one versus the other, both, neither. We can go on and on. But what's very interesting here is the fact that, especially in surrogacy, which is really how it emerged, and in part it's Avram's fault again. I think he was one of the first to approach Shlomo Zalman on this issue. And the idea is that when you're a surrogate, when a Jewish woman cannot carry a child because she doesn't have a uterus, whatever reason, so they do in vitro fertilization and they implant this embryo into a surrogate. If the surrogate is not Jewish, right, who is the halachic mother? So up until a few years ago, everybody thought a gestational surrogate was you're hiring an incubator, she's just providing the nutrients. But it's not true. What's happening is that lifestyle of that surrogate is going to have genetic, epigenetic impact on that child. There's a biological connection. It goes even more than that. I don't know if you know this, but there's what's called maternal fetal stem cell exchange. This is an unbelievable topic. It's been known for about 20, 30 years. That stem cells from the mother cross the placenta, embed into the woman, and stay within the woman's neurons, muscle for the lifetime, and we know this, because if you take a biopsy of a woman who's had male children, you'll find in the muscle, you'll find XY chromosomes. How does she get a Y chromosome? She's female. It's clear that this happens. And we know the reverse happens as well, that stem cells from the woman, from the mother, crosses the placenta, embeds into the fetus. There are hundreds of cases of babies, unfortunately, born with tumors, and they have to remove the tumors when they're born, and they do a genetic analysis of the origin of the tumor, and it does not come from the baby's cell, it comes from the stem cells of the mother. Now, why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu do this? It's one reason is A, to establish this biological connection, but I have another theory, which is bearing out. It turns out that, for those of you who know anything about stem cells are a little bit unique. For anybody who understands transplantation, most of you do, in order to be a good donor, you have to have similar types of genes called major histocompatibility complex genes. The more similar those genes are, the better transplant recipient donor will work. Now, stem cells, first of all, you have to ask a very logical question. Why doesn't a pregnant woman reject the fetus? Fetus is a foreign body. Yes, it's related, but the husband... But it's foreign, and the mother doesn't reject it. Now, the classical explanation, of course, is that the hormones that are generated in pregnancy suppress the immune system. Absolutely true, but that's not sufficient. So we know in the lab at Columbia that stem cells, when they're embryonic stem cells, and very early, they don't have any of these protein complex, the MHC. They develop very slowly. So our idea is that what happens is that as a woman is carrying the fetus in the beginning, those stem cells come in to the mother, the pregnant woman, and tolerize her immune system to accept the fetus. Very interesting. We haven't proven it, but just something that I thought I'd share with you. Okay. Now, let's think about the Jewish views on human behavior versus epigenetic studies. Oops. Let's try this again. Okay. We know Esav was born red and hairy, and who was destined to become murderer. He was, at least according to some, an identical twin to Yaakov. We know that Anna developed the whole concept of climb. He was the first one to create the vicious mule, and he had a personality to create evil things because he's born out of incest. That's okay. Now, we know that some people are born with genes that really convey evil tendencies. What do we do with this? Violence, adultery, we can go on and on to describe them. And now I will show you how epigenetics can modify positively or negatively these things. Rava says, I was born under the sign of Mars, I'm not a murderer, and Abaya says to him, yes, you do spill blood. And again, there's a genetic predisposition to certain behaviors. And what's interesting, there's a study done in the last 6 months, that the season in which a fetus is born determines part of their personality and their health. If you're born in the summer, it's different than born in winter. Very analogous, in a certain way to what the Gemara is saying, being born under a certain horoscope. So I think that's very fascinating. And we know that one specific mitzvah can impact one specific behavior. We know that if you're violent, the Gemara says, become a moyo, become a shaychet. And in doing that, you will control this violent behavior. And same thing is true in epigenetics. Lifestyles can affect both a single epigenetic marker or multiple epigenetic markers. And we know some mitzvahs, such as limud haTorah, tzedakah, and chesed, can result in multiple personality changes. And again, lifestyles can affect not only one gene, but can affect many, many genes. And this is being clear. We have identified several hundred of these genetically controlled epigenetic mechanisms. So what does this all tell us? That tells us the principle what I call spiritual epigenetics. I can't prove it. It's only a theory. If you give me $10 million, I could prove it. I'll tell you how to do that. It's very easy to prove. But it basically means that how we live not only affects our health, but affects our yetzer hara and affects our personality. And this is how we can control who we are. It's a very profound, and I hope it's true, principle. And it's interesting, if you look at the Rambam in Hilchos Teshuva, he says something fascinating. He says as follows. He says, look, what do you do between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur? You have to do more mitzvahs. And what mitzvah does he say you should do? Tzedakah. Why? I believe because tzedakah has this multiple epigenetic impact. That doing this, giving tzedakah, has more than just one mitzvah, has multiple things. The story of Cain and Hevel, it's really remarkable. You have here, Cain kills Hevel. He comes, as Rav Tanlu would say, he comes to Kadosh Baruch Hu and says, you're blaming me? You gave me the genetic predisposition to violence. I didn't know what I was doing. And what does the Kadosh Baruch Hu say? He says, yes, you're right. You have a genetic predisposition to do evil. You have the power to control that. What is this power? What is the power to control how you behave? What is the power to control how you act? And I think, and I propose to you, that this power is what we call spiritual epigenetics. So let me conclude with a very interesting interpretation of a pasuk that we all know. Yaakov is renamed. Vayomer lo Yaakovi amer od shimcha ki im Israel ki sarita im Elokim v'im anashim v'tuchal. It's a very, very difficult pasuk because who did Yaakov fight with? There are different perushim. Who is the Elokim he fought with? Who are the anashim? And there are different explanations. I'd like to offer you one. Rabbeinu Bachya and the Malbim claimed that Yaakov was fighting with his yetzer hara. Wasn't Sar Shel Esav, it was his own Yetzer Hara. And the men that Yaakov fought with, according to the Medrash, were Lavan and Esav. How did Yaakov prevail over these internal and external influences that regulate his behavior? So it's interesting that the Medrash says, Yaakov says, Im Lavan Garti, Vitarag Mitzvah Shamarti. And Yaakov, before he even entered, he spent 14 years learning in the Yeshiva of Shem Ve'Ever. Limud haTorah, doing mitzvahs, prepared him to deal with both these aspects. And the idea is that who's the Im Elokim? I would suggest to you, probably not true, but it's just a thought, that he prevailed over nature, Elokim, nature, the biological instincts that everybody has, v'me'al anashim, nurture. So this is a pasuk, in my mind, that alludes to the whole idea of spiritual epigenetics. And it's interesting, the Talmud in Kedushin says that I created the evil Yitzhara and also gave the Torah as a tavlin. What's tavlin? There are very numerous explanations. It's a spice. It's an addition, antidote. And what does that mean? The Chidon the Gras says that learning Torah transforms the Yitzhara to good. It doesn't eliminate. You cannot eliminate the Yetzer Hara. In epigenetics, you can't delete the gene, but you can transform the gene by turning it on and turning it off. And this whole idea is that we can use epigenetics to transform our yetzer hara into something that's good. So limud haTorah, it doesn't eliminate it, but allows us to manage it. Understand that, again, it's not a fait accompli. It has to be continual. If you stop a lifestyle that is positive, that those markers will be turned off again or turned on again. It has to be constant. It's not something, oh, I'm just going to now lead a healthy diet for a year. It's not going to happen. It has to be continual, and it matches pretty well. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik states that the study of Torah instills happiness and joy that allows human beings to control the Yetzer Hara. And it's very interesting how the Rav takes this, that he says in Halachic Man, Torah cannot be acquired in a state of melancholy and depression. The Gemara that states that evil inclination subdues him, reminds himself of the day of death, only speaks of a spiritual sick person. But a healthy halachic man should engage in holiness, happiness, joy of life to subdue the Yetzer Hara. And in fact, the later Musar movement accepted this philosophy. What is telling us a very profound effect, that being depressed is not good for your Yetzer Hara. Taking mitzvahs within a state of joy and happiness has a very positive epigenetic result in helping you become a better person. So, in summary, there are very many mechanisms by which the human body can regulate gene expression. I've just touched on one, epigenetics. It destroys the idea that we are bound by DNA and destiny. And there are halachic implications of epigenetics and also Musar implications of epigenetics that I've tried to present to you. Yaakov Avinu really is the one to introduce us to spiritual epigenetics. It's not my own or Rav Tendler's. And mitzvahs and chesed, I believe, could control gene expression. How would I prove this? It's very simple. Take somebody who was not from and do all the millions of epigenetic markers on his genome. Let him become a Baal Tshuva 3 years later and do epigenetic markers, and I guarantee you, although I've never done it, I guarantee you that I will be able to highlight what genes are turned on and off by changing a lifestyle from no mitzvahs to mitzvahs. And I think this cartoon says a lot. You gave them free will, now they're bound to get into trouble. All right, if they ask you any questions you don't know, just say it's due to epigenetics. So we have a lot of time because people like to ask a lot of questions. So feel free to ask any questions on genetics or epigenetics that you have. Yes?
So do you think that all environmental factors work through epigenetics, or is there
other mechanisms that depend on the genetic mechanism? That's an excellent question. Do all environmental factors work through epigenetics? I think that's the trend. I would not go on out on the limb and say it's that other factors. Listen, we can control epigenetics by looking at what we call junk DNA, and they can synthesize small RNA molecules that can turn on and turn off message. There's a lot of other mechanisms that works. You have genes that counterbalance the deleterious disease genes. So a person who has certain tumor suppressor genes will overcome certain cancers that somebody else might have. So there's a lot of other things. But the trend today is that environment works primarily by epigenetics. It's a very good question. Yes?
I think both are true, to be honest.
About 30 years ago, certain scientists claimed that there was a gene that regulated on the Y chromosome homosexual behavior. It was put down. Last year or so, it seems that there are genetic components that control homosexuality. What's interesting is that when you look at the benefit, listen, gene mutations, they try to be beneficial. We survive because we mutate. We do. And there's no better example than none of us would be alive if we didn't induce mutations. When all of you know, when you receive a bacterial infection, right, the bacteria triggers a host of B cells to mutate. They make antibodies, and they're going to mutate until we get the right B cell that makes the right antibody to tag that specific bacteria, and then we're cured. If it wasn't for the ability of these B cells, these plasma cells, to mutate, we never would be alive. So you have, on one hand, there's a certain benefit to mutations. So there's a number of papers that claim, and I'm not a psychologist, so I can't comment on this, that having one gene that trends to be what they call the homosexual gene makes you a nicer person. If you have two genes, it carries you to an extreme. So there is, I believe, a genetic component, and there's also a epigenetic component, too, that we just don't know how to deal with. I have a good friend who's in Israel. He's a very famous psychiatrist, and he deals with a lot of homosexual patients from community. And I ask him, can you cure them? They want to be cured. He says he doesn't know how to do that. We don't know exactly what are the mechanisms by which to control this. So I think both are very important, and I don't know how it's going to end up. Does that answer your question? We are,
yeah,
but it's
one direction.
Right, but both. But we have to incorporate both in some way. Right, of course. That's a cultural thing. Yes, good question. Yes. Absolutely. Not only that, I'll tell you something that you probably don't know. You've all heard about CRISPR, gene editing, right? We can now genetically or chemically change a base pair from one to another. There are probably 6,000 diseases that result of a single base pair change. We can now change that, and we can reverse that. It's an amazing technology. I will predict that it will come into clinical practice, despite what you're reading about in the literature. It's just a matter of time until we get all the safety issues down. But one of the things that's really interesting about CRISPR and Cas9 is not only can we change the base pair, we can change the epigenetic markers. We can use this technology to put a marker on a specific gene to turn it off. We can use this technology to put another marker on the gene to turn the gene on. So the power that we potentially have using epigenetics by specific molecular cellular mechanisms are incredible. And yes, when we do in the lab, I can identify exactly which base pair has been methylated, which histone has been methylated, which histone has been acetylated. Yes.
I
think you're right. I'm not an expert in this, and it's a very difficult. What diseases are going to be affected, which are not, is a really important question. I can tell you an amazing study we did in mice that we know has been done in mice. We didn't do it. There are certain genetic diseases in which the mice develop a liver failure in the hepatocytes, and they die within 2 months. Mice normally live 2 years. It's due to one gene mutation. And we can now take CRISPR, package it, put into a viral vector that only affects the hepatocytes. And now we treat these young mice with this viral infected with a CRISPR-Cas9, change it, and these mice, almost 90% live the full 2 years. Okay? What's interesting about that is that the scientists went back and says, what percent of the hepatocytes were actually corrected? And it turns out it's only 10%. Only 10% deficiency was low, only 10% were, but that was sufficient to cure the mice. Now that's one disease. Every disease has its own pattern. And when you deal with a cancer leukemia, which I know much less than you do, I can't explain it, but I think these are very important questions that has to be asked. Yes. Ah, my good friend. Can I say a little? So we go back to YU, long time ago. And although he's a great physician, he has great children, he is an unbelievable musician and a song paradigm and parodies. And I don't want to embarrass him, but I remember him more for his song parodies than I do from anything else. He's fantastic. Yes, welcome. Do you want to sing for us? I would predict yes. I haven't seen anybody. Okay, the question is, if somebody is depressed and you put them on an antidepressant, does that have epigenetic impact to change the mood? I don't know. I haven't seen any studies on that specifically. It's very expensive to do these epigenetics. It's not like you're going in and doing a titer for MMR or something like that. It's very expensive, and I'm sure it will be done. It doesn't surprise me. I have read a couple of papers that certain antidepressants, Prozac, for example, some of these take months to really see an effect, and the question is why. And there is a theory, again, I'm not a psychiatrist, I don't know, that part of it is it regenerates some of the stem cells, the endogenous stem cells within the brain to compensate for the depression. That's why it takes a long time. I don't know if that's true, but it wouldn't surprise me, but I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. It's a good question. Yes? Yes, I think it's not going to be pill. I think it's going to be by gene editing. I think we'll be able to turn on and turn off any gene that we want. And this raises other halakhic issues of what we can do. And I'm sure you've heard talks about that. When it comes to gene editing, there's no doubt that if it's for medical reason, whether it's an embryo, whether it's a pre-implanted embryo, an implanted embryo, whether it's an adult, if there's a defined medical purpose and the risks are not that great, I don't think there's an abnormal vouch for that. There's any halakhic restriction to do gene editing. On the other hand, for non-medical reasons, if I want to become a basketball player to dunk, I'm only 5'8", I can put gazelle genes in my legs, and I can jump 2.5 times my height. Why? Because gazelle genes generate fast twitch muscles, makes them capable of jumping very high. Am I allowed to do that to become a basketball player? I think those are real issues that are less likely to be approved. So one has to differentiate. But in the future, I think it's not going to be a pill per se. It could be, but it's going to be some sort of intervention where you intervene with gene editing or maybe life, but you don't have to do that. If we understand how lifestyle works, and not all lifestyle is going to work the same way in all people. I mean, in other words, I may be very happy, and it may not have the same epigenetic effect as my wife. I mean, there are precision medicine, there's a lot of variability comes into this, and that's why it's a probability. So yes, I think as you go on to precision medicine, not only will we look at the actual gene sequencing, but we'll look at the epigenetic markers, and hopefully that will give us a better handle on how to treat all of these dire illnesses that we face, cancer, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, whatever it is. Yes?
We'll be sending blood samples out of the lab.
Yes. 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 Absolutely. I'll tell you a real consequence of this today. A person who has a tumor, we don't know the origins of the tumor. So tumor cells, as you all know, they grow, they divide, they die, they go into the blood, especially the leukemias, lymphomas. You have a lot of DNA from the tumor. So what a company in Israel has done, very clever, from Hebrew University, what they do is they take the free DNA in the blood from the tumor, and they look at the epigenetic markers of that DNA, and they can identify what the tissue origin of that DNA is. Is it coming from the brain, the pancreas, the liver? So here's a clear application that I think is going to have, you know, practical ramifications in terms of diagnostics, where you can really look at these markers, identify the cell of origin, and figure out where it's coming from. Yes? I can't answer that, but I'll give you some very interesting piece of information. Longevity is determined by at least two mechanisms that we understand. I don't know if you know about what telomeres are. Telomeres are at the end of every chromosome. You're born with a certain length of telomere, it's about 15,000 base pairs. As you age, the rate of these telomeres shorten until you get to about 5,000, and then you go to Gan Eden, clearly. So what determines in part how long you live is in part determined by how quickly those telomeres shorten in your body, okay? What's interesting is there's another area that is involved in longevity. There are genes in your DNA that code for ribosomes. Ribosomes are very important in protein synthesis. They're called ribosomal DNA. As you age, that part of the DNA gets more epigenetic markers, more methylation, until you get to a point you cannot make enough ribosomal protein and you die. So we have two mechanisms, genetic mechanisms that help determine longevity. Theoretically, can we lengthen our telomeres? Absolutely true. There are enzymes that we know about that can lengthen the telomeres. One of the most interesting results of Dolly, the first cloned adult mammal, was the fact that they looked at her telomeres. Now, Dolly was cloned using an adult cell of a six-year-old sheep. So the question was, what was the length of Dolly's telomere? Was her telomeres like a newborn, which would have been a certain length? Or was it like a six-year-old sheep, which would have been shorter? Or somewhere in between or different? And it turned out that her telomeres were in between, longer than a six-year-old sheep, but shorter than a newborn. And that led to a whole series of investigations. We now know of telomerases, enzymes that can lengthen your telomeres. So theoretically, and cancer cells unfortunately have a lot of these telomerases, your white cells have them, and we can theoretically reprogram you to at least live much, much longer. We probably can reprogram the ribosomal DNA as well to remove these epigenetic markers. That only tells you about life, longevity. It does not tell you about the disease associated. And you ask about Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, dementia, cancers. I don't know. We're going to investigate that. I'm sure it'll become known the next decade or so. But it's a very good question. Does it mean that you can live to be 150 without disease? I don't know. I believe in what Kadosh Baruch Hu told us, that before Kadosh Baruch Hu created sickness, he created the cure. So if we have a cure, if we can find the cure, we'll solve all the sickness. He's the premier physician for preventative medicine, and I think that all this is going to play into role.
Thank you.
That's an excellent question. It's beyond the scope of this talk, because I'll tell you two things. Unfortunately, 40% of all papers published in Science and Nature magazine are irreproducible. They haven't been reproduced. Look at the statistics that are done on a lot of these papers. They're pretty crappy. We don't know how to do good statistics, especially with big data. I've spoken to the head of Yahoo on a big data analysis, my friends. Statistics is very hard. We can have associations. I agree with you. Do they tell us something? I hope they do. But until we really get a good handle how to do this accurately, how to look at the mechanisms and how to do this, I don't know how to answer your question. Right now, it's guilt by association, like I showed you in many cases. Some of it's better than others, but one has to be careful. I agree. Yes? So what makes you uncomfortable? I'm glad you're... So I'll quote you a famous Ramban. Ramban says, how is it in the future we're going to have without disease, right? So the Ramban says something very amazing. He says, why? Because if you purify the water and you purify the food, you will live a healthier life. This is the Ramban talking, almost 900 years ago. So the idea of diet and environment, even the Ramban understood that. And I think that that plays a role. Now, does it work on everybody? You're asking very good questions. I don't know. But we're just entering a whole new generation of epigenetics and lifestyle. And all these questions are going to have to be addressed. And I don't know what the answer is going to be. I hope it's going to be positive. Yes, right. We know that, right? If you live in Africa and you have sickle cell carrier, you're going to be less likely to get malaria. I mean, I agree. I think you're raising a very important point. And I said, while we look at many disease states as being harmful, there are some evolutionary benefits to that. So I think these are very important questions to integrate all of this. And this is not only for epigenetics, it's all for precision medicine. Once you start going to the genome and start understanding all the genes that turned on and turned off and what's going on here, it has great ramifications on the whole implication of human life and human disease and health. That's a good question. Anything else? So let me ask you a question. How many of you would volunteer to have epigenetic testing done? Wow. And do you think it has a spiritual connotation? Anybody believe this? There's such a concept of spiritual epigenetics? A few. All right. Okay. Sure. Both are good. You need the money, you need the, they say that when Moshe Soloveitchik got his first position in the Rabbanut, he asked his father, Reb Chaim, what does it take to be a good Rav of a community? He says, don't worry about giving shirim, you give good shirim. Don't worry about halacha, psak. If you have any questions, you know who to turn to. What you have to focus on is chesed. On staka, take care of the aniyim, the yesomim, the almanot, and that's hard. That's not natural. And that's, I think, a very important message.